It's the NPR News Update for Wednesday, January 9th, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Matt Sepik in for Phil Picardi. In the news today, a ninth grader from suburban Minneapolis has died of the flu. DFLers in the Minnesota legislature outline their priorities for the session, and the mayor of Duluth tries to raise awareness about sex trafficking in Minnesota. A church in St. Louis Park is holding a memorial service this evening for a 14-year-old girl who died of influenza. Westwood Lutheran Church says on its website that Carly Christensen died Tuesday afternoon with her family by her side. Carly was a ninth grader at St. Louis Park Senior High. She was otherwise healthy, but was the fifth person to die of influenza this flu season in Minnesota. Since the start of the season, nearly 600 people in the state have been hospitalized for the flu. At the end of December, a 17-year-old boy from Texas died of flu complications at a hospital in St. Paul after visiting relatives in the area. Democrats officially took charge of the Minnesota House and Senate this week during largely ceremonial floor sessions yesterday that marked the start of the 2013 legislative session. DFL leaders in both chambers stressed their priority is to craft a structurally sound state budget for the next 2 years. There's a projected deficit, though, of $1.1 billion. House Speaker Paul Thiessen of Minneapolis says the priority bills will include the implementation of a state health insurance exchange as well as a payback schedule for the money owed to schools as part of earlier budget deals. Thiessen also says Democrats will propose a new property tax rebate.
It's going to be modeled on the PTR, the property tax refund program, but we're going to require the Department of Revenue to notify people when they qualify, and it's going to have if you pay over a certain percentage of your income, we're going to bring that percentage down.
Thiessen and other DFL leaders have stressed their top priority is the budget, but that work will unfold over several months once Governor Mark Dayton presents his initial spending proposal later on in January. DFLers say they'll govern for the benefit of all Minnesotans, but the new Republican Senate Minority Leader David Hahn of Eden Prairie predicts there will be plenty of partisan disagreements this year.
As a state, we all don't agree on every issue, and we think it's important that there be the robust debate and an opportunity for the things that need to be heard, that those things be heard. So we look forward to that.
The first day for bill introductions is Thursday. DFL leaders plan to outline their first batch of bills during a news conference today. Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents arrested 10 people on Tuesday at a Sparbo Farms facility in Litchfield, Minnesota. Public Affairs Officer Sean Neudauer says the agents were conducting a criminal investigation, but says the arrests were based on what he calls administrative charges. Neudauer would not specify those charges, but says immigration violations often fall into that category.
The act of being in the country illegally and, say, getting arrested by a police officer for speeding and then being held for an immigration violation in itself is generally an administrative violation, whereas criminal investigations deal with, eventually and hopefully from our perspective, criminal charges.
Neudauer says the criminal investigation is still going on. Two of the 10 people arrested have been released. In a statement, Sparbo Farm says it takes compliance with immigration law seriously. The statement also says there were no food safety issues raised during the investigation. Sparbo is one of the largest egg producers in the United States. It's headquartered in Litchfield, about 65 miles west of Minneapolis. Some Iranian students at the University of Minnesota say TCF Bank has tried to discriminate against them after they got notices that their bank accounts would be closed. Alex Friedrich reports.
More than 20 Iranian students have received the notices, which provide no explanation for the closures. TCF says only that bank officials saw account activity they found concerning. A university spokeswoman says TCF told the U the move was related to U.S. sanctions against Iran. But TCF spokesman Jason Korstange says the bank sends such letters to any customer with questionable account activity.
You know, this is not just an Iranian student event.
He now says students can keep their accounts if they adequately answer the bank's concerns. The students say they've either made no illegal foreign transactions or no foreign transactions at all. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Leaders of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe announced that they are planning to buy two St. Paul hotels. Sources familiar with the deal identify those hotels as the Crown Plaza and the DoubleTree Hilton, which were put on the market last year. St. Paul Chamber of Commerce President Matt Kramer says he welcomes news of the investment downtown, particularly in the wake of the announcement that Macy's would close its downtown St. Paul store.
You know, it's just as likely that these two hotels could have been sold to some out-of-state chain or out-of-state investment group that doesn't know Minnesota and certainly doesn't know downtown St. Paul. And so to have the band, a bunch of Minnesotans, invest in downtown St. Paul is a positive because they understand the market, they're going to know how to make money off of this.
The band says the purchases are aimed at economic development and diversification of their businesses, and they have no immediate interest in expanding gambling to the Twin Cities. In Duluth, Mayor Don Ness is signing a proclamation today declaring January Trafficking Awareness Month. The goal is to raise awareness of girls being sold for sex and to honor the survivors of sexual exploitation. In Minnesota and across the United States, young girls are bought and sold for sex every day. And as Dan Crocker reports, a group of advocates and law enforcement officials in Duluth is trying to increase awareness of the dangers and bring an end to the practice.
Like most Minnesotans, Jane hadn't given much thought to the issue of girls being lured from home and sold for sex until this summer, when the Duluth professional came home over her lunch hour to check in on her 18-year-old daughter, who had just graduated from high school.
I walked in the door and I called out her name, and she wasn't there, and I just knew.
NPR News has agreed not to broadcast Jane's last name because she still fears for her daughter's safety, but Duluth police confirm her story. One of her daughter's friends told her a Twin Cities man bought her daughter a bus ticket to St. Paul after they'd met on the internet. After an agonizing week, a Duluth police officer called to say they were heading to a vacant lot in the metro area where they'd traced her daughter's cell phone.
And that was the lowest point, literally, of my life.
But police only found a cell phone battery. The fact there was no body was a relief. Jane later learned from St. Paul police that her daughter was passed to a second and then a third man, though not necessarily for money or sex.
Ultimately, this fellow tried to sell her to a fourth man for $100. My daughter refused, and then number three ended up taking her back to a house. And that's where she ultimately was found by the police.
Jane says her daughter suffers from a disability, which police say made her vulnerable to someone with bad intentions.
He said, "Your daughter might as well have had a sign on, say, pick me." They know how to talk to young women, how to get close to them. They literally groom them, and girls don't understand this is where they're headed.
A 2010 study done in collaboration with the Women's Foundation of Minnesota estimates more than 200 girls in the state are sold for sex each month through the internet and escort services. The study found even more are sold in private homes and on the street. Candy Harshner, executive director of the Program for Aid to Victims of Sexual Assault in Duluth, says for many victims, it often starts out as survival sex.
Where young women were trading sex for a place to stay, a couch to sleep on, a place to live, for money to get food. Or the other scenario that's pretty common is they were doing it to thank their boyfriend. They never call it their pimp, it's their boyfriend, it's or a good friend, or somebody who's taking care of them.
According to the U.S. Department of Justice, the average age of girls when they're first sold for sex is between 12 and 14. The Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition recently interviewed over 100 Native trafficking victims, over half from the Duluth area. 98% were homeless at the time. 92% said they wanted to leave their situation immediately. Sarah Curtis, with the Duluth group Mending the Sacred Hoop, helped coordinate the interviews.
In fact, there were a couple of women that I got moved that day that were in such a dangerous situation that said, if I go back, I think I'm going to get hurt.
St. Louis County Attorney Mark Rubin says it's a huge challenge to get trafficking victims to testify in a prosecution because they feel trapped and powerless.
And the one question that they always will ask us, if we're trying to encourage them to go ahead and be part of this, because we'll never force someone to be part of a prosecution in this area, they'll ask us, can you keep me safe?
Rubin says the answer has been no, but he says a new Duluth sex trafficking task force has begun to develop a protocol to help women. For Jane, whose daughter is back in Duluth and getting the help she needs, educating parents about the dangers girls face is crucial.
I'm speaking out because I never dreamed this could enter my life. And I learned way more than I ever wanted to know in my life about sex trafficking and how quickly it can happen and change everything.
The question is how much the efforts in cities like Duluth can change the risks facing girls. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Back to the state capitol now. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is holding its annual legislative session kickoff dinner tonight in St. Paul. The group of business leaders will be watching the goings-on at the capitol closely to see how DFL Governor Mark Dayton and DFL legislative leaders approach this year's budget. But as Tom Scheck reports, at least some members of the business community appear to be softening their hardline stance against tax increases.
The executive director of the Minnesota Business Partnership is no fan of tax hikes. For years, Charlie Weaver has lobbied against higher taxes, but Weaver is also a realist and knows DFL control of the legislature and the governor's office means things have changed.
We're pragmatic enough to recognize the politics of the situation, but we just want to make sure it's an informed decision when they do make the decision.
Weaver says his organization, which is made up of more than 100 chief executives of Minnesota companies, is willing to concede that taxes will go up. His main focus is now on ensuring the tax hikes don't make Minnesota less competitive. He says requiring online retailers to collect sales taxes and expanding the sales tax to clothing are ideas his organization can back. He adds that the business partnership is opposed to Governor Dayton's proposed income tax hike on top earners, but he acknowledges it's likely to happen because it's a top priority for Dayton.
We hope to be at the table to talk about at what level. You know, I think the governor may propose 5% increase in the current level. We're at the table saying that would make us number one in the country. Let's not do that.
While Weaver and the Minnesota Business Partnership seem to be conceding the fact that taxes will go up, the state's other large business group isn't yet. Laura Bordelon with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce says Dayton and lawmakers need to prove they're willing to make significant spending cuts before considering tax hikes.
We are not at this point looking at tax increases as the way to go. We're looking at the whole structure and how to make it more competitive. There's things that you can lower. There may be some things that you can increase, but we'd want to have that conversation as part of a whole tax reform discussion rather than simply a revenue-raising discussion.
Kathy Thunheim is CEO of a public relations company and a senior advisor to Governor Dayton on the economy and job creation. Thunheim says Dayton is committed to making the cost of government more predictable, which means he'll propose a sustainable and fair budget that includes spending cuts and tax increases.
This isn't about more taxes. It's about making the math work and make sure that, like any business person understands, you have to be able to balance these things if you want it to be predictable.
DFL House Speaker Paul Thiessen says he'll continue to reach out to the business community to discuss higher taxes.
We're going to need them at the table just as we're going to need, everybody. We're going to need farmers. We're going to need, employees, ordinary citizens, we're going to need everybody to pitch in and come up with the right solutions.
Thiessen also emphasized there will be spending cuts to help erase a budget deficit projected to be $1.1 billion. Republican Representative Greg Davids of Preston says Democrats will be on their own when it comes to raising taxes. Davids said Republicans will vote against any tax hike and work to highlight the DFL votes for tax increases in the next election.
For one-party control, they will do anything they want to, and they want to raise taxes. Some have said as much as $6 billion. So I guess what we need to look at is how do we minimize the damage until 2 years from now we come back in a majority of the Minnesota House and clean up the mess that they made.
Governor Dayton is expected to release his tax overhaul and budget by January 22nd. DFL legislative leaders say they'll wait until March before they release their budget proposal. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News, at the Capitol.
In other news, the East Metro Integration District holds public hearings tonight and tomorrow night on proposals that could close the district's two schools or transfer their operation. Tim Post reports.
The district, known as EMID, was created in the 1990s to form two integrated arts and science schools for St. Paul and nine neighboring districts. Now the EMID board is considering closing the schools and is entertaining plans by other districts to take over their operation. Susan Larson's son attends an EMID school in Woodbury.
What we're hoping is that what really happens is that the EMID board chooses to withdraw governance of the schools, which makes them available for other organizations to operate.
The Roseville District has proposed taking over the EMID school in Maplewood. There are proposals from four districts to take over the EMID school in Woodbury. The EMID board will make its final decision in 2 weeks. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And there's some more good news from the world of the arts today. On Monday, we learned the Penumbra Theater raised enough money to resume productions this spring. And now the Southern Theater in Minneapolis is emerging from a financial crisis that nearly killed it in 2011. After the theater's collapse, the Southern survived by stripping down to a single staff person and becoming a rental facility for other local arts groups. Reporter Chris Roberts has an update on how things are going at the Southern.
The days when the Southern had a full staff and performers constantly milling around are gone. Now, when sole staff member and general manager Damon Runnels punches in the electronic combination and walks through the main entrance, he's usually the only one there. And the 102-year-old theater gets spooky sometimes, especially at night.
And as the darkness just takes over more and more of the building, you just feel something at your back.
The occasionally ghostly environment goes with a job Runnels essentially created for himself. Years of chronic cash flow problems and a lack of financial oversight led to the Southern's collapse in 2011. Things came to a head when the McKnight Foundation asked the Southern to return more than $350,000 in artist fellowship grants it had inappropriately used for general operating purposes. It sparked an uproar in the local art scene, and the board struggled to find a way forward. To keep the Southern open, Runnels offered to run the theater as a rental facility.
There were no other options but to have one person try and manage this space, and that's just the way the numbers fell.
In his new role, Runnels not only operates the Southern, he consults artists and arts groups on how best to use what it offers.
But without dictating what their piece should be or how it should function.
And pop! Good. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, pop, 8.
That prescription has worked out well for members of Collide Theatrical Dance Company, here rehearsing for their upcoming February show. With its more than 200 seats, dramatic exposed walls, and broad stage, Collide founder Regina Peluso felt the Southern was a perfect space.
We don't need elaborate sets. We already have, you know, this beautiful scenery, plus a prime Minneapolis location, and a relatively safe rental budget.
38 Twin Cities artists and groups rented the Southern in 2012. Manager Damon Runnels says it allowed the theater to eliminate a $53,000 debt it owed to artists, vendors, ticket holders, and independent contractors.
To the people that are still harboring some resentment against what happened at the Southern, I would say the slate has been nearly wiped clean.
But the Southern still owes the McKnight Foundation nearly $370,000. Southern Theater Board Chair Gary Peterson says the theater has begun conversations with McKnight about repaying the money.
I'm confident that it's possible that over some period of time we could pay it back. Whether that would be easy, that would be challenging.
In the meantime, the Southern has invited the community to help it decide what it should become. Pangea World Theater staged one of its most successful productions ever, House on Mango Street, at the Southern last spring. Having been on the Southern schedule in previous years, Pangea Artistic Director Dipankar Mukherjee prefers being a renter. Mukherjee thinks it gives more groups access to a great facility.
Everybody who's applying for the space has a fair shot at it. And to me, this is much more of a democratic, transparent, open procedure.
St. Paul choreographer Penelope Free held a dance concert at the Southern last fall, which also went well, but Free ended up burdened with all the things the Southern used to provide itself, including marketing, ticket sales, and refreshments.
By the end of the run, I really felt the loss of those services.
As the Southern evolves, it's likely to move away from being merely a rental facility, but it probably won't return to its former role as a programmer and presenter. General Manager Damon Runnels says one idea is for the Southern to house several performing arts groups and then have something approaching a membership model,
where people pay a monthly access fee and then they can come see whatever's happening in the space.
But in the short term, the Southern will remain a rental theater for at least another year. Chris Roberts, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And that'll do it for the NPR News Update for Wednesday, January 9th. I'm Matt Sepik. Thanks for downloading.